Harold, would you please turn down the pulpit mic just a little bit, please?
Comfort for, that's too low.
Comfort for a longing heart. I tell you, Christmas season as we are approaching it is probably one of the most nostalgic moments of the year. Would you agree? You have probably those moments where you remember your childhood experiences, those special times when the children were young and they were all screaming, giggling, and so excited about opening their gifts. And now you find yourself just going back and remembering it. This nostalgia is not just for this season, but it's a part of what happens a whole lot. When I travel back down east and go into the little settlement where I was born, the house that I was born in, and my grandfather had built, and it's changed. They've got white paint on it now, and it used to be just the plain shingles unpainted. And it had a big oak tree that I remember, which was so distinctive for our home, and they finally had to cut that down. And so every now and again, I only do it when I'm alone in the car and nobody else is with me, but I'll drive up slowly and I'll stop and I'll just sit there and look at the house. And you know what I'm doing? I'm remembering all the past. I'll remember my childhood. I'll remember the moments that occurred in that time. That's nostalgia. But you know, when you go back and do that, you grasp and you look and you try to reach, and somehow you can't. It's not there. What you're grasping is your memory, but you cannot make it come alive again. Do you notice that? It's so funny. Our sons, their first memory for 3 to 5 years was living in a funeral home. Some of you probably know that. But that was their first. Second son was born while we were there, and the first one was only 3 months old. So that's their only first year, first life memory. We moved away and went to another state, and I started pastoring a church, and they were laughing somewhat later as they grew up, how they would sit around. These were only like they were 8 or 9 years old at this time. You know, a couple of years removed from the funeral home experience, and you would hardly think that was a memorable, happy moment. And yet they would sit and talk about all the things that they did in the funeral home, and they'd almost start to cry. And they were laughing and telling us, you know, it was just nostalgia just drew them back, and of all places, of course. But that was their good memories. But that just shows up in so many places in our lives. If you're an immigrant from England, Ireland, or Scotland, you'll probably just be brought to tears at some little beautiful, pristine voice singing "Oh, Danny Boy," right? But there's always those triggers. Well, this turns out to be a very, not normal, only normal, but a very universal experience for all of us. C.S. Lewis talks about this thing called longing within our hearts. And it's a universal human heart, this longing for something more. Longing, as he said, for that far-off country that you've never been to and you haven't seen yet. But there's something there, that far-off country that is still before us. T.S. Eliot, the great poet and writer, also drew on that whole theme of longing as well. So it is something, as you'd say, an open space in the human heart that somehow is not filled, and it has a restless feeling to it, and it's like a magnet that draws us to something, but we just can't describe it. We can't describe it because we've never actually experienced it, you know. We're drawn to it, but we can't get a hold of it. But we can't hide it because our experience is constantly teasing us with it and wanting us to move toward it. And so we feel it. So it's not like we can hide it and disappear. C.S. Lewis says that when you take this and try to pursue this moment to grasp onto it, it's a cheat. It's cheating you because you think you can grasp it, but he says you actually cannot get a firm hold on it. It's a sweet satisfaction that we sense and that we seek, but you will take us through it, but it will not come from it, and it will not be it. So this is a longing. And this is the way he describes it. C.S. Lewis, he said, These experiences are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune that we have never heard, and news from a country we have never yet visited. Keep this thing in mind for him, this far-off country. Now back to the Isaiah passage of the Hebrews in Babylon. But the first picture that we have that I'm going to bring to you is in Psalm 137. What happened, the great Babylonian Empire was expanding and taking out on provinces and little countries all around the region of the Middle East. So it was a great empire. They came and took over Palestine and they destroyed the temple, and they took all the leaders and the educated and the elites and the political leaders from the country and took them to Babylon so that there would be just the farmers and workers there, but they could never mount a government and so on. The temple was destroyed in 586 BC. And you can imagine what that felt like for the exiles to be taken into this strange country. They didn't know the language, it was a different religion and everything. Jeremiah, the prophet, actually told them, wrote to them and said, settle down, marry, have families, make a living where you are. It doesn't look like you're coming home. And so there they were, Psalm 137. They were still longing for their homeland. They were longing for their temple that had been destroyed. And here's how they lament the loss. By the rivers of Babylon. If you don't know it from the Bible, you know it from Godspell, I think. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and there we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willow, there we hung up our harps. Couldn't play anymore. For there our captives asked us for songs, and our tormentors asked for mercy, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. Just sing it to it. How could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. Longing for something that had seemed to have passed, and yet they wanted it. But now we go to the reading from chapter 40, where something has happened. They're still there, but they need a word of comfort. Or God has decided to give them the word of comfort through a prophet. Things had changed. Persia was now emerging as the great empire, and all the countries around that had been allies to Babylon were being taken over by Persia. Babylon was losing its power, and something was afoot. Cyrus of Persia comes to the exiles, and he said, I'm going to help you go home. You're going to go back home. You're going back to Palestine. You're going back to Jerusalem. And this was good news to them. Isaiah the prophet, the book of Isaiah, probably Isaiah only wrote up to chapter 39. And another prophet, leaves himself totally unnamed, comes in and writes chapters 40 to 55. And it's all in poetic form. It's one of the highest expressions of Hebrew poetry in all their literature. And the theme is that there's good news. Things are changing, and you have got hope. And while all the rest of the world was actually looking at Babylon and Persia, trying to figure out what's going on, there's a voice, it says, a voice comes from the council of heaven, calling the hearers to redirect their attention. You're looking at the wrong thing. This is not where the real action is going to be. You and I need to hear that from time to time if you watch too much news. In verse 3:40, in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, which means your God is coming. Does that sound like an Advent theme to you? In Mark 1, we already see it. in terms of John the Baptist saying the same thing, prepare the way of the Lord. And it is an Advent voice for you and me that is addressing the longing of every human heart that God has placed in there. You see, that longing came from God. And God said, I'm not going to let you be settled in this kind of world that you're in until you see my salvation played out on the scene of human history and for the whole cosmos and the whole world. And I have to read part of these passages because you have the opening, you have three stanzas, as it were, in this poetic form. And they are a comfort for the longing heart because they speak to us as well as to those exiles languishing by the rivers of Babylon. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Listen, when you listen to the Messiah this season, listen for that part. Comfort, comfort my people in this great tenor voice that comes in. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins, because she understood that her going after the pagan gods of Baal and all of that, this was God's discipline, not just punishment, but discipline for her to bring her back to himself. He speaks so warmly to her. He talks about, you are my people. I am your God. There is this sense of you, we are in covenant together. So after the languish and the longing for home, they hear these words that are our comfort and our promise to them that God is with them and is going to do something. And I want to tell you and me, which is the word to them, your enemy owes you nothing. You understand that? Your enemy owes you nothing. But also Mother Nature owes you nothing. Mother Nature can look beautiful when you're standing on a mountaintop looking across that at a gorgeous sunset. But when it produces an avalanche or an earthquake and eats you up and you disappear, that's Mother Nature. I've often said Mother Nature does not forgive, but God does. And brothers and sisters, all of you who now think karma is a cool thing, karma is not a friend to you either. It owes you nothing. And the God of heaven and earth, Yahweh of the Jewish people, owe us and them absolutely nothing except his promise that he has loved you from the beginning, will continue to love you forevermore, and that he will keep his promise to restore that which he created. That's what he owes you and me. In this short passage, we have these three stanzas and three messages that are important to you and me. One is, God himself will bring you home. It is God who will do it. In verses 3-5, a voice cries, in the wilderness prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain will be made low. The uneven ground will become level, and the rough places a plain. And the glory of the God of God will be revealed, and all flesh will see it together. For the mouth of the God has spoken. God is present and leading his people. He didn't say, I'm going to make a way for you and you get somebody out there to take you through, and I'm not going to be with you. No, throughout all of Israel's history, God was always present in their destitute as prisoners and exiles in Egypt and going through the wilderness. He was with them as recalcitrant as they were. He was there. And so when the passage says, make a highway for our God, God is going to be there leading his people. And it's an amazing thing. You might not pick it up, but it goes straight through the desert. All the other routes through that region went around the desert because it's too hostile. So they had to make the long trek around. He says, make a way straight through the desert. And where there is rough places like hills, we're going to have a task. This ain't no Trans-Canada Highway yet. And we're going to level off the hills. And where you've got valleys and streams and rivers going through and you can't get across, fill them up with the dirt from the mountains. And you make it straight so that there's an easy path and you can see it right through the desert until you get to your destination. I'm going to make this easy for you because you are my people. And you're going to have the picture of the great emperor in his chariots going across the desert and a host of people, the broken exiles and the lost ones who are now coming home. Brothers and sisters, you can imagine what it was like then. You can imagine what it would be like and what it is for us even today. The second verse is a message that only God will be there forever. A voice cry, and I, the prophet unnamed, says, "What shall I cry?" And he says, "All flesh is grass, and all its beauty is like the flower of the field. The grass withers and the flower fades when the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people is grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever." They got that message. They said, talk about grass fading and flowers dying. We know that. Look at the destitution, the destituteness of Israel or of our land. And Jerusalem is just flattened and the temple is gone. Said, we are like that grass. That's us. And he said, you're looking at the wrong thing, folks. He said, I'm talking about Babylon too. You think when you went in there and you looked at the majestic buildings and the beautiful artwork and the hanging gardens that they talked about in Babylon, it was so beautiful and rich and powerful. This would never die. And he says, it's on its way down. Because there's nothing in this world, no institution that lasts forever. Only what? The word of our God will stand forever. I remember about a month ago standing in Taipei at the headquarters of a Chinese-founded church, and they had a presentation room and some of their artifacts, if you call it, from their history and so on. And we went into a presentation room. There was a plaque on the wall, and I looked down on the floor, and I thought it was unusual. And as I looked, there was cracks all through it and pieces that had been broken and had been all kind of sort of put together. They did it deliberately and then sealed it over. And then the leader who was telling us said, take a look at the plaque. Heaven and earth shall pass away. And he said, look at the floor. He said, that's what this symbolizes, that heaven and earth, everything that we think is going to be steady for us and it's going to hold us, he said, is going to crack up and break up. It's gone, going to be gone. But he said, following Mark 13, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words will never pass away. That's exactly what this passage said. My word will endure forever. The voice in the third one. Here's where you and I really come in. Get you up to a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good tidings. Lift up your voice with strength. O Jerusalem, herald of good tidings. Lift up, fear not, and say to the city of Judah, behold your God, and he is coming with his reward. He is coming with power and might, and he will be like a shepherd that will feed his flock and gather the lambs in his arms. He will carry them in his bosom and gently lead those that are young. What's he saying? You've got a job to do. He is calling you and me into that great promise that's moving forward through the desert, into the promised land. Remember Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous speech, I see standing on the mountaintop. He saw something. He knew there was a longing in his heart. So many of them saw and experienced. But he on the mountaintop could see the promised land. And this is the picture he's giving to us. And this is what's going on here. But when you see, have that longing, and that longing gets to be directed towards the kingdom of God and what God is doing, then you know you're on the track. And if you don't understand what it means to be called to proclaim, as it says, to proclaim what God is doing to others, let the people know of Judah, we're here to let you know that there's something happening back in Babylon, and we are coming back. And you need to be a part of that. And just proclaim to the people what God is going to, what God is doing. And when you do, you will see that you will want to be a part of it. All I said earlier, things when you have a young child that finally knows that there is a Christmas coming, do you think that they wouldn't be motivated to get involved before Christmas? And so that's the thing that's often missing. We don't yet fully believe in our hearts in the promise of God, that he is doing a great thing and he's going to complete it. And even if you don't see it completed in your lifetime, God is going to bring the completion about. I'm going back to C.S. Lewis in Chronicles Narnia, finish with this. There's a scene, and it tells what this longing is kind of like. So the young people are traveling toward Aslan, who is the image of Christ. And they're talking as they go along their journey. And they take notice of their surroundings. And it still seemed to be early, and the morning freshness was in the air. They kept on stopping to look around and to look behind them, partly because it was so beautiful, but partly also because there was something about it which they could not understand. "Peter," said Lucy, "where is this, do you suppose?" "I don't know," said the High King. "It reminds me of somewhere, but I can't give it a name. Could it be somewhere we once stayed for a holiday when we were very, very small?" "Well, it would have to have been a very jolly good holiday," said Eustace. "I bet there isn't a country like this anywhere in our world. Look at the colors. You couldn't get a blue like the blue on these mountains in our world." Lucy said, "Yeah, they're different. They have more colors on them, and they look further away than I remembered. And they're more like the real thing," said the Lord Diggory softly. "More like the real thing." That's an Advent promise.